Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Is modern racism a product of secularization and the decline of Christian universalism? The debate has raged for decades, but up to now, the actual racial views of historical atheists and freethinkers have never been subjected to a systematic analysis. In his new book, Race in a Godless World, Atheism, Race, and Civilization, 1850 to 1914, Nathan Alexander sets out to correct the oversight. The book centers on Britain and the United States in the second half of the 19th century, a time when popular atheist movements were emerging and skepticism about the truth of Christianity was becoming widespread. This newly embraced secularization created a paradox. How could Western civilization represent the pinnacle of human progress, as most white atheists accepted, when the majority of these societies still believed in Christianity? The result of this tension was a profound ambivalence regarding issues of racial and civilizational superiority. At times, white atheists assented to scientific racism and hierarchical conceptions of civilization. At others, they denounced racial prejudice and spoke favorably of non-white, non-Western civilizations. Covering racial and evolutionary science, imperialism, slavery, and racial prejudice in theory and practice, Alexander's book provides a much-needed account of the complex and sometimes contradictory ideas espoused by the transatlantic community of atheists and freethinkers. It also reflects on the social dimension of irreligiousness, exploring how working-class atheists' experience of exclusion could make them sympathetic to other marginalized groups. Nathan Alexander is a Canadian historian researching the history of race and racism and the history of atheism and secularization. He finished his PhD at the University of St. Andrews in the UK and was most recently a postdoctoral fellow at the Max Weber Center for Advanced Cultural and Social Studies with the University of Erfurt in Germany. He joins me today to talk about his latest book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Secularism. My name's Carrie Lynn Evans, and I'm joined today by Nathan Alexander to talk about his book, Race in a Godless World, Atheism, Race, and Civilization, 1850 to 1914. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about yourself and how you came to work in your field.
Right. Well, I got interested in the history of race and racism during my master's degree. And during that time, actually, I was sort of undergoing a religious transformation, I suppose. I went from being a Christian to being an atheist around that time. So when I was doing my master's and working on the history of race and racism, I was realizing all of the ways that religion intersected with race and vice versa. But as I was also realizing that there were no real studies looking at the ways atheism or unbelief sort of intersected with race and racism. So that's sort of how I got interested in this topic. And then eventually I would go on to do my PhD about that. And that sort of formed the basis for the book.
Okay, fantastic. So first, perhaps outline for us in broad terms the major debate that is at hand here. One side argues that the rise of secularism in the late 19th century was directly responsible for enabling and justifying racist views. And then the other side argues that actually it was Christian beliefs that were more detrimental here. So how does each side elaborate these arguments?
Right. So I think I should just say at the start, I mean, these are not... These are sort of arguments I've sort of picked up in the secondary literature, but there's not specific arguments saying, you know, on the one side, secularism causes racism or Christianity causes racism. I mean, not quite so explicit as that. But taking the first point about secularism sort of leading to racism, one could sort of make the argument that in the 18th and 19th centuries, sort of Christianity, the foundations of Christianity begin to be questioned. The idea that all humans are created by God, created in the image of God, that all humans descend from Adam and Eve directly. These are all beginning to be questioned. And some people are thinking of humans in terms of... being part of the natural world, being just like any other species of animal. And so this leads some thinkers to argue that, you know, perhaps humanity is divided into different races. And then from there, we can say different races might be superior or inferior to each other. So this is sort of one way you can argue that secularism or the decline of religious authority opens the way to thinking about race in sort of hierarchical terms, that it opens the way for racism. So that's one side sort of the story. But on the other hand, people could argue actually it was Christianity that sort of paved the way for racism. So you could point to the ways in which the Bible justifies slavery in different ways, how this urge to proselytize, to spread the gospel around the world, how this can lead to imperialism, how this can lead to viewing other cultures, other peoples as inferior because they don't have, you know, they don't share the same religion. They share a quote unquote inferior religion. Yeah, so all of these, and also this Christianity's long history of anti-Semitism, and the way that this could be sort of treated in biological terms, and how that could sort of lead to thinking in terms of distinct sort of races. So there are these two kind of competing theories.
So give us a sense of the cultural context in this period as well. What important developments were going on in the world that may have had a significant impact on these issues?
So I should say the two countries that I'm looking at are Britain and the US. So in the 19th century, the big contexts are sort of the rise of imperialism. Of course, European countries had been sort of expanding around the world for the previous centuries, but really in the 19th century, this really begins to ramp up, especially, you know, new technology enables more and more conquests. In the U.S., slavery exists, obviously, and then it stops after the Civil War. And so there is debates about how to integrate the descendants or former slaves or the descendants of slaves into the society and what rights they should be given and so on. So that's one sort of context. And the other context is sort of the religious context that in the late 19th century, we see a growing movement of atheists and other sorts of non-believers So they're beginning to become more outspoken. They're forming organizations, and they've got newspapers and books and things that are putting out their arguments in a way that really didn't happen before in such an explicit way.
So I want to go back to one of the issues at hand that you kind of already alluded to, and that's about the origins of humanity, whether you take a Christian view about Adam and Eve versus a Darwinistic view or an evolutionary view of something else. So tell us, what are monogenesis and polygenesis? Which groups advocated for which side in this debate, and what do these competing narratives have to do with racism?
Right. So monogenesis means single origin, and polygenesis means multiple origins. So monogenesis is sort of a theory that says, you know, all of humanity has a single origin. All races have a single origin. And typically, in the sort of the Christian view, this is an Adam and Eve. They're the literal ancestors of all of humanity. On the other side is polygenesis, which says that there are distinct human groups. They all have a separate origin, so they're not related to each other. So they're permanently separate, and this means, for example, that members of different races couldn't procreate together, or they would produce offspring that are in some ways defective or something like this. So this polygenesis view, it goes against the Christian view because it's sort of denying that all humans are descended from Adam and Eve, and that's the Christian view. And it poses a further challenge because if that's true, if it's true that Adam and Eve aren't the parents of all of humanity, the original sin that Adam and Eve commit in the Garden of Eden doesn't get passed down to all of humanity, and therefore Jesus's salvation also doesn't get passed down to all of humanity, only to, you know, a select few of these direct ancestors of Adam. So this debate has implications for race, but also for theology. So this means Christians typically support monogenesis, and atheists are interested in exploring sort of polygenesis because it does sort of cast doubt on the Adam and Eve story and more generally the entire foundation of Christianity. It's also possible to have a sort of a monogenesis in a secular way, but maybe we can get into that later.
Yeah, let's talk about a little in more detail about Charles Darwin and how he figures into this picture. So how did atheists in the 19th century incorporate these ideas into their understanding of race?
Right. So Darwin, Darwin was an unbeliever in Christianity. And so he put forward this idea of evolution that was a kind of monogenesis. So he definitely didn't believe in like the literal truth that Adam and Eve were the parents of all of humanity. But he did have this idea that all of humans, and indeed all species, had a single origin. Like, we all share a common ancestor, although this is naturalistic and not religious. So definitely, atheists were able to sort of use Darwin's ideas because they did undermine sort of the idea that humanity was created specifically or especially by God. So they're interested in Darwin's theories, and they did incorporate evolution into their arguments. But it's also true that one can have ideas about evolution that are sort of informed by polygenesis as well. So you could argue that different species of apes were the ancestors of different races, so that evolution is still true. It's just that there are sort of separate pathways to each human race. Or you could argue that humanity had a single origin, but nonetheless, soon after humans evolved, they took very different evolutionary paths, and this leads to the development of different races. So this sort of preserves a kind of polygenesis within evolution. But some atheists were also followers of Darwin, and this idea of a kind of a secular monogenesis.
If I recall correctly, you kind of found that you could take whichever belief you wanted and mold it to fit whatever your views were on race to begin with, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, also, sometimes the views, you know, they're not totally coherent, even sort of within the same thinker. You know, people pick and choose different aspects of theories that they like. And, you know, some people liked Darwin, but they said, nonetheless, I think, I agree with Darwin, but I do think he's wrong about all races having a single origin. So it really does come down in part to, like, you know, what argument you sort of want to make about race, and then you'll find the evidence and theories that you want to have supporting that.
Right. And you write that Darwin's theories influenced people's ideas about the development of civilizations as well, almost maybe close to what we would call social Darwinism today. So can you tell us what was going on here?
Yeah. So people, yeah, in the 19th century were sort of looking out at the world and different societies. And this idea goes back to the Enlightenment, that basically that there's sort of a single path that every society takes. You know, you begin as a hunter-gatherer, then you develop agriculture, then you industrialize, and then you sort of develop a modern society. So basically people at this time sort of thought that there was kind of a linear path that civilizations took. And so thinkers at this time looked around and identified societies around the world and said, you know, they're at different levels of civilization, like they're on different pathways to like a modern society. So people in the 19th century, like particularly after Darwin, began to sort of incorporate the idea of like a natural selection into the way societies develop. So, if a society faced struggles, this might be a way in which they could advance to a higher level of civilization. So that's how sort of evolution kind of fits into the way people look at civilizations around the world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And you discovered perhaps a rather surprising sense of affinity felt by atheists with what they, at the time, deemed the savage races, due to what they felt was a shared persecution at the hands of more powerful Christians. So that must have been a fascinating discovery. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, definitely. I was really surprised by that. I think like when someone's studying, you know, race in the 19th century, you know, it's not surprising to find people arguing that, you know, the one race is superior to another. I mean, that's not surprising, but it's really interesting to me, like, to find that these white atheists were really sort of going against the grain of their society and saying, and against the grain of these ideas that said, you know, savage, quote unquote, savage races are inferior. These atheists were actually saying, you know, well, actually, maybe there's some positive virtues to these so-called savage groups. And so particularly, it happened that many atheists in the 19th century came from the working classes. So they're, you know, they're a bit poorer than the rest of society, and they see that, you know, they're living in a very unjust society. And they're looking out at these, again, quote unquote, savage groups. But they say, you know, these societies look a lot more egalitarian than their own. And so they're thinking, like, maybe these societies are actually in some way superior to ours. They've got, you know, more pure ideas about charity and sort of ensuring everyone, you know, everyone benefits equally in a society, and so on. So yeah, so that was definitely a big surprise to come across this sort of dialogue. I didn't expect it, really.
So do you think it's fair to call these atheists anti-imperialist or anti-colonial, or is that too strong?
I think it might be a bit too strong. Definitely they were, I think they're sort of skeptical of imperialism. Like they're definitely questioning whether it was the right thing to sort of, you know, trample over these cultures and impose Western lifestyle. Definitely they definitely didn't like Christian missionaries doing that. But I think, while they were skeptical, I think there's also, some who nonetheless thought they believed in more a sort of secular civilizing, project. So they didn't want to see the people in these other societies, converted to Christianity, but they wouldn't mind seeing them, you know, adopt a sort of secular lifestyle or worldview. So I do think it would be too much to say they're, you know, completely opposed to to imperialism, but they were definitely skeptical of it and more skeptical than their contemporaries.
Interesting. So you write that Western atheists also took a decidedly different attitude from their Christian compatriots towards India, China, and the Far East. So how do they understand the Eastern religions and cultures?
It's really interesting because, well, they see these kind of Eastern religions as, well, in some sense, they see them more as sort of secular worldviews. So like Confucianism in China, they don't see this really as a supernatural religion, but more of just someone, sort of like more of an ethical system, an ethical guide to life. And even like Buddhism, again, they see that not as necessarily a supernatural religion, but more as a ethical philosophy, I suppose. So it's quite interesting again that, you know, in the 19th century, I guess most of say like white people in Britain and the US might, you know, look down on these other Eastern cultures, but again, atheists saw them as in some ways compatriots, I guess, that they both shared a sort of a secular ethical mindset. Yeah, but I mean, and that sort of, well, they also sort of identified free thinkers in these societies to other sort of non-believers, and they report on the positive reception of atheist or other sorts of scientific works, for example, in these societies. So I think they saw them as in some ways quite similar to themselves.
Interesting. I guess they would have had some degree of contact, actual contact with these, like I'm thinking India, especially, mm-hmm. obviously Britain was there. I wonder how much contact your average American or British atheist would have had with China or cultures of the Far East.
Yeah.
Was this speculation from afar or?
Yeah, I think it probably was. Yeah, definitely it's true. Like India is, there was more direct experience, I suppose, with India, given that, you know, people could travel there and vice versa, that there were lots of Indians living in Britain. But actually, so yeah, I do think, yeah, like accounts of China and Japan, like probably these are secondhand accounts of people who've traveled there or in cases of people from China or Japan going to the US or Britain. There are cases. So and a really interesting one that I found is this guy from China called Wang Qinfu. So he was born in China but he was raised by American missionary parents. But then as he grew up, he went to the US and he was a Christian there, but he soon lost his faith and became a free thinker. And actually, it's funny because he called himself the first missionary, secular missionary or something from China to the U.S. And he wrote an article a series of articles in the North American Review in the late 19th century. It's called Why I Am a Heathen. And there he's sort of talking about, why he uses the term heathen sort of ironically, because that's what, you know, Christians call, you know, non-Christian peoples. But he sort of makes an argument for kind of a secular sort of worldview. It is true then that, you know, that direct information about some of these countries is not available, but there are cases of Wang Qinfu of actual Chinese people coming to the US or to Britain and speaking about their backgrounds and sort of in his case his secular sort of free thinking worldview.
And this is what I think makes your next chapter so interesting, because it's almost like where the rubber meets the road, right? About their racial ideas. Clearly, white atheists have a wide variety of really interesting ideas about race and science, some of them more objective and evidence-based than others. But maybe it is kind of in the abstract, right? And so what about African Americans? What were the white atheists' views towards the Black folks living among them?
Yeah. So before the Civil War, this isn't something I talk about a lot in my book, but there are a lot of abolitionists who are free thinkers. So that there's sort of that tradition there before the Civil War. But mostly I focus on the aftermath of the Civil War, and what sort of how the descendants of slavery are sort of reintegrated into society or not. So I found that, yeah, like you say, like this is a case where it moves beyond sort of abstract theorizing about people halfway around the world. Like these are people within one's own borders. So it is a different sort of case. But I found a diversity of views among atheists. On the one side, there are those who take a more we'll say racist view that African Americans shouldn't have the right to vote, or it was a mistake to give them the right to vote. That segregation is okay and things like this. But again, I did find strong cases of atheists speaking out against these racist ideas, speaking out against lynching, for example, or against the ways new civil rights after the end of the Civil War were sort of rolled back towards the end of the 19th century. So one key figure here is Robert Ingersoll, who was one of probably the most famous white atheists or agnostic in the late 19th century in the U.S. But he was, he was quite outspoken about defending the rights of African Americans. And he tried to use his platform to speak out on their behalf. So there is this sort of, again, this diversity of views on that question.
And it seems like your research points in the direction that by the turn of the century, atheists had pretty much come down on the side of strongly rejecting scientific racism, embracing instead the role of the environment, say, rather than inherited traits informing personalities. So tell us about that. What evidence did you uncover for this understanding?
Yes. Yeah, particularly by the end of the 19th century, you do see some pretty clear cases of atheists arguing explicitly against scientific racism. Just two people I'll talk about quickly. In Britain, there was this guy called J.M. Robertson, who is Scottish and a freethinker. So he was very much opposed to these ideas of scientific racism, and he wrote a number of works arguing against it. I think the main one is this book called The Saxon and the Celt, when he sort of argues in the late 19th century, there was this idea that all of history or the history of Europe could be explained by the different sorts of white races who were there. So it wasn't the case that all white people were seen as the part of the same race. There were different divisions, so Saxons and Celts and Mediterraneans and so on. In this work, J.M. Robertson is really criticizing this view and saying that it's a lot more important. Biology is not that important. It's really all about your environment or your socio-political context. These are the things that really matter, and not some kind of ideas about different races. So that's Robertson. In the U.S., there was a guy called James F. Morton, who was another white atheist active in the free thought scene at the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th. And actually, he wrote this book in 1906 called The Curse of Race Prejudice, where he really makes a strong case against prejudice based on race, and does it from a secular perspective. So he and from a Darwinian perspective, he says, Darwin shows that we're all descended from a common ancestor. So if that's true, then racism doesn't make any sense because we're all related. And any sort of differences that might exist are really trivial and not that important. So these two fairly prominent free thinkers in the late 19th century, early 20th century are beginning to really come out and explicitly argue against these ideas of scientific racism that were sort of popular around this time.
So your book brings together such important findings and really sheds light on a corner of intellectual thought that's been previously overlooked. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think your research can tell us about the intersection of religious and racial views today?
Yeah, it's a question I sort of consider at the end of my book. Although I definitely think, you know, to look at contemporary issues, I think would be a book in itself. But I do talk about that a bit at the end of my book. So I think, well, there's a number of different sort of threads that one can pick up. I think the one is to say that I sort of identified, I guess, in the book that there is this tradition among atheists and other non-religious people about, you know, questioning ideas of racism. And I think that trend has continued. And I think many or most atheists today have quote unquote progressive views about race. So that's sort of one thread. But another thing that I kind of talk about in the conclusion is that atheists do have this kind of skeptical mindset, and that it's also informed by the historical fact that atheists have often been outsiders in their society, which leads them to be skeptical even more so of any sort of received truths in society or questioning taboos. So in the 19th century, this led some atheists to question ideas of racial superiority because that was sort of the given belief. But now I think today the sort of standard view, I guess, is that all races are equal. And so this that fact that it's sort of the conventional view, the accepted view, has led some atheists, I mean, not all, not most, just some segment of atheists to kind of question this idea that all races are equal. So sort of anecdotal, but you sort of see on social media, for example, some atheist individuals sort of willing to explore ideas that there are racial differences and racial differences, for example, in IQ. So they're interested sort of in breaking, you know, breaking this taboo of racial equality. And also in the conclusion, I talk a little bit about the alt-right, this sort of rebranded, I guess, sort of white supremacist movement. But I quote from Richard Spencer, who is sort of I think he coined the term alt-right, and I guess he's one of the major figures. But anyway, I quote an interview from him where he says, you know, the average, he's talking about the average member of the alt-right, and he sort of gives a different demographics. And he said, with regard to religion, they're probably non-religious or atheist. So I think that's sort of an interesting thing, that there's a sort of secular wing of the white supremacist movement. So I mean, I think in contemporary world, there's all sorts of intersections, I guess, between race and racism and atheism.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way of breaking down the way people interact with each other. Well, Nathan, I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come on the show and telling us about your book. But before you go, can you tell us what you're currently working on?
Yeah, so my current academic project is I'm looking actually at the history of the word racism. So those are sort of an issue that I came up with like writing this book, thinking about sort of the language I might be using in the book. So racism, sort of a more, the word itself is a more modern word, that it really doesn't become widely used until the 20th century. So So one of the things I was thinking about as I was writing this book was, you know, whether I should be using the word racism, because it's not a term that people in the 19th century had. So that sort of made me interested in the history of the word. So the plan is that will be another book, potentially, a history of the word racism. So that's sort of my other academic project that's happening right now.
Great. All right. Well, as I said, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed your book. I was really glad to have the chance to chat with you in person about it. It was very cool to be approached on social media. So that was great. Thank you. So I will wish you a good afternoon for now. Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.
I want to thank you for listening to New Books in Secularism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Nathan Alexander about his new book, Race in a Godless World: Atheism, Race, and Civilization. If you'd like to find out more about Nathan and what he's written, check out his website at nathangalexander.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please write us a positive review on iTunes, post about us on social media, or tell a friend. The New Books Network is a not-for-profit organization, so all the buzz you can help us generate goes a long way to supporting this work. I'm also interested in hearing from you about your thoughts on this podcast and the material we cover. You can find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynnland. That's at CarrieLynnland. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you have a book you'd like covered on one of our shows? Contact us through our website, newbooksnetwork.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. In the meantime, I'll wish you an à la prochaine from Quebec until my next conversation about new books in secularism.